Right. Looking money around and figuring out how to get allocated. It was oversubscribed, so. And at a later meeting, Gordon said, this is something that really makes me feel good, is that we didn't get all that much out of the Fairchild deal, but that gave us a grubstake to go on and invest in other things.
Right.
Here everybody has participated. What is the big success story is investing in Intel, and, you know, they all made a lot of, had the opportunity to make a lot of money in that if they kept their stuff.
Right.
So.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it ever in that, in quite that way.
That was one of the best investments of all time.
Yeah.
And nearly all of us sold out. You know, Intel was not a success there for a while, and it looked pretty sad there in the early 80s. So a lot of people had made a lot of money, but sold out, and it's still at a small fraction of what it turned out to be in the 90s. And,
right.
And some of the dynamic decisions they made in those days are extremely powerful, difficult decisions to make. And,
oh, for example, to get out of memory.
You get out of memory. God, what a decision.
That is a very interesting decision of, you know, be similar to Fairchild saying, well, let's get out of transistors and just bet it all on integrated circuits.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
and,
right.
In a period like that.
Yeah, and it was the right decision. It was a pretty agonizing one to make.
I would imagine.
I'm sure Gordon has gone into that.
He has. That was
some detail.
Extremely difficult for them to do. What are your thoughts about, just to stick with that theme for a minute, or about Gordon Moore for a minute, on his contributions at Intel? Do you have a sense of that at all, or opinion of that at all?
Nothing really firsthand. He
right.
never discussed it very much. And
sure.
He's fairly modest about this kind of a thing, and wasn't
yes.
going to discuss it very much. I could see, and in discussions with Art Rock, that noise was getting more and more out of things, and not following through, or his interest had changed.
Mm-hmm.
And Gordon, who had always worked in Noyce's shadow all that time, whereas I personally, as I said, I talked, you know, I felt Noyce, I mean, Moore had made enormous contributions who were unrecognized at that time. And as Gordon rose in the company, you know, gradually turning out to be chairman, I was pleased to see that that it worked out. Does that answer?
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, as I said, whenever I saw him, we were cordial about this. I know he said, I went to one of the annual meetings where he'd been in the ill-fated watch business. And he said, God, he said, I just get a stomach ache thinking going into the board meeting and getting beat up on this damn watch thing again. But that was the only time I saw him discussing the negative sides of his less pleasant aspects of being running the place there. And he had a good board.
Yeah.
And Chuck Young at UCLA was sort of behind the scenes. I was on another board with Chuck for a while, and I could see what a powerhouse he would be in a kind of a thing. And the other board members were good. So it was a well-run company. With the financial reverses they suffered, you know, when IBM bought out part of the company.
Mm-hmm.
Those were tough times. They probably would not have succeeded if they hadn't made some of these dynamic decisions.
Yeah.
They did, and Gordon's role became more and more understood and appreciated as years passed.
In actually executing or making those decisions.
And as I said, my early opinion of Noyce, Moore, was that he didn't do this in a way that was going to blow his own horn. He was sort of interested in seeing the result be achieved,
mm-hmm.
and achieved through other people.
Hmm.
That was a view, I don't know how accurate it is, but that's the view I hold of him.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I said.
And what would you say about his, some people have described him as being an accomplished sort of judge of technological proposals, or as having some, as having sort of a technical judgment that was,
I think it's
unusual.
I think it's extremely high.
Yeah.
Mm. I've felt that. And the work he was doing at Fairchild on getting the MOS started,
mm-hmm.
and it took a long time for that to take off. At one point I was interested in MOS for Fairchild for a Teledyne project, and went over and discussed it with him. Could Fairchild do it? He said, no, the time isn't right yet. MOS is not a reliable enough thing yet for a big scale thing like you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But the results speak for themselves, is that he picked the right technology with Andy and
mm-hmm.
the other people involved. And while it never took off at Fairchild, it was the foundation of the
right
Intel. Well, I've never doubted his ability to make good decisions like that.
Were you, did you see Gordon and Betty Moore much in the Fairchild or the Shockley days, or was there a sort of married guy
fashion? It was married
divide,
guy.
Yeah.
Not quite that way.
Well,
I saw Jean and
mm-hmm.
and Sheldon. I have dinner with them quite often.
Mm.
And I never saw Betty, except to be some big, fairly big event where
right.
husbands and wives would get together.
Right.
But,
I'm just pausing for a moment to look at some of these questions. I have some. We've talked about Moore's Law. And we've talked a little bit about, well, I guess we talked about it at lunch, which was this paper that you wrote in 1998, comparing sort of the advent of printing with the advent of the silicon technology, the book with the computer, and this dependence of communication or information innovations upon materials technology.
Yes.
So for the printing, there's paper, inks, metals.
Metallurgy was strong.
And for the silicon or the computer technology, the transistor computer technology relies on, you know, a longer list, one
yes.
might say, of materials technologies. I suppose my question there is to ask you about your reflection on working on the making seminal developments in sort of the seminal period of the development of the silicon technology. How strong of a dependence do you think that is on the materials technologies weighted against maybe other factors? You know, is it a defining feature?
It was a defining feature completely. I mean, it was the ability to get pure pure silicon to start with
mm-hmm.
was key, and that was pushing materials technology, as Tannenbaum will tell you, to the limits.
Right.
And being able to dope it to understand the diffusion process in enough detail to solve these aggravating and non-ending problems with surface contamination,
mm-hmm.
Getting into epitaxy, mm-hmm. and an eye and the implantation techniques. Mm-hmm. It's all strictly deep understanding materials. So it's a materials-oriented business, and whether you call it chemistry or physics or solid-state physics or industrial engineering or something, it was a tie-in here with all of these disciplines that
right
was key. It really is a materials business.
Yeah, transformation of materials to have
one form to another, I mean, all of the side materials that were needed that don't show up in the final product but are essential for the manufacture.
Rinses
and passes and polishes and
right.
the whole thing. So. And I find it very gratifying now to see, when I talk to the people running MIT, how they're trying to make interdisciplinary stuff the leading thing at the university, and just breaking down all these artificial divisions that took place.
And to organize it around more problem centers
and there's an awful lot of resistance from people that are professors of something who want to maintain the status quo and getting rid of that, and especially with all these communications laboratories and things.
Yeah. You
need that. And in the area of materials, looking at this from a lot broader point of view than you do if you're just stirring a bucket of something and pass it on to somebody else to store. Somebody else to stir it for a while.
If you think about some of these, we've talked about these key kind of materials developments or problem areas in the semiconductor story. Are there people really stand out in your mind as people who grappled with or made an advance in these materials areas?
I don't think that much of it. I mean, I know the big chemical companies that turned into this very reliable silicon manufacturers, mm-hmm. and turned into the ability to make progressively larger wafers were key in this.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, I think, the
right
the key thing. As far as purity of materials and stuff, you just tell them you need it pure, and they
that'll work.
And they do it.
Was that the situation that you often found yourself in with even going back to working with the photoresists, that you were really telling your suppliers, really defining the problems?
That we need a better one, or we steadily need it, and so Kodak jumped on that and just kept at it for years, making steadily improved photoresists.
Mm.
And they got real good. And it's not just the resist, but the properties that enable you to get it off when you want to. You can't scrub it. you have to have something that is a compatible, complete chemical system.
Right.
But you can get it on, get it off when you want to, and it'll stand up under these high temperatures when need be, and
mm-hmm.
stand up under these strange acids.
Well, then I guess what I should ask you at this point, is there any aspect of your technical career that I haven't touched on that you really think I should have, something, an area that we really should explore?
I don't think so. We got through what I learned in school, how I applied it, and how I used the stuff, the semiconductor things, and how at Teledyne, when I had the job of vice president of technology, I could be a very quick study on a business that I'd never seen before with my physics background, and get in there and figure out real fast what they were doing and the general makeup of the company. So, and I'm really pleased to have been educated as a physicist.
For that analytical?
Not so much for the physics I learned. I haven't used quantum mechanics, I don't think, since I got out of school. But you know, I have indirectly, because I'm looking at understand quantum phenomena. I've used that indirectly. But I've never directly solved Schrodinger's equation again, or something like that. But the education I got was very broad, especially for the time. And it was a lot broader than... And it became... as things became more interdisciplinary, some of that broke down. But but just the basic way of thinking as a physicist has stood me in good stead.
How would you describe that? As a way of approaching and defining?
Looking at a lot of things that don't look like they're related terribly well to start with, and making some sense out of it. I don't know. Really, is how much of that is cause and effect, how much of that was just ingrained in me, or how much was the physics education, but the physics education's formalized it.
Right.
A lot. And, so I'm pleased with my education. If I had stayed in optics, I would have had a very disjointed time. I was about the last class that studied classical optics, with designing on a desk calculator, where you had to work to 10 places past the decimal point, and any trig table gives you 3 places. So for every calculation, you had to calculate the trig function you were going to use to do the next step. It was an extraordinarily ponderous thing, and the good designers like Kingslake, a lot of that was just intuition with them. They can make very intelligent guesses. But just as I left MIT, the first computers started to be using for this, and that just took over completely. So I gave a talk at the commencement at Rochester a couple of years ago and pointed that out, that the value of a broad education that enables you to change than a narrow education. I would strongly recommend everybody, especially on an undergraduate level, that they get a as broad an education as possible. I still feel that when I see the young people I'm in position to give some advice to, that take some of these, especially liberal arts courses, that can enrich your life forever and give you an appreciation of the world that you're not going to get being narrowly focused.
Right.
It enables you, if your interests change throughout life, which they should, you can...
To have the flexibility.
Yeah. Arbuckle, that ran the business school at Stanford, put that well. He said, man's like a delicate plant. He should be, to really thrive, he should be repotted every 4 years, 6 years. That's true. And I think this is a good thing for term limits for various offices. And I had a good discussion last week with the president of Rochester, who feels his time is up, and we both felt it was the right thing to do. And it's time for somebody else to start doing this, and time for him to do something else.
Well, then I did want to ask just a few questions about about some aspects of your second, non-technical, maybe second careers. We in this period after you left Teledyne, we talked about, you know, your ongoing collecting activities and how they changed with, in particular, the African art.
Yeah.
And how you began to collect the agricultural labels.
Yeah.
Did those collecting activities lead you kind of directly into art history work, or was that something that you...
I would say yes.
Yeah.
Commercial art history work.
Mm-hmm.
And I could start seeing like an Orange Crate labels, Art Nouveau being replaced by Art Deco, replaced by commercial art. And these were very dramatic steps. If you look at the labels, you can see this. And that interested me to document that.
Mm-hmm.
And then talking about lithography from a technical angle and how that was utilized throughout making labels, stippling effects and color combinations, and that led directly into my present interest on trying to document the whole lithography history.
I'm sure do you think there's any connection between, you know, the lithographic processes that you were deeply into with the semiconductor industry and your...
I don't think so. Lithography for the semiconductor was a misnomer. It's not litho, it means stone.
Right.
And that was the last thing we were involved with was standard half-tone lithography, or anything. Mm-hmm. Just a name that we're using by exposing an image and changing it around a bit. No, I don't think it was anything.
It was through the agricultural labels.
Yeah. And which turned into a very strong interest. And Gordon and I have written about four books about various aspects of the label industry and commercial art along those lines.
And then how did the interest in documenting the history turn into the decision to start your own press?
Well, I had heard almost universal complaints by people that somebody else editing and publishing their book, that they wanted to change it all around or not do it at all, or buy the rights and then scrap the book. And I said, I have the resources to just figure out how to do this myself, and I can write the book that I want to write and get it published and sell it. So I had to learn all the things about getting books published and bound and all that, paper opacity so that you don't see the other side of the sheet. And I gradually learned, and then how to sell them. And I've had, as I say, very good sales, and all these books are either been reprinted or gone out of print that I've done. And I've done about a dozen books now. And they just keep selling. And most book companies are, again, like the venture capital, they're playing for the one big hit and scrap books before their time. And I just said, if it's a good book, you just wait long enough, you're going to sell them all. Which is the case. And it makes a lot of sense. And I've been always able to write a book, and it was the first book on the subject, and I would been very happy to read it if it existed, but if not, I ended up getting involved enough to write it.
And was it through this California commercial art that you became interested in the watercolorists?
No, that was another interest, and that was Gordon McClellan's interest, my partner, who had been collecting this stuff since he was young, and said, let's collaborate on this, and we interviewed people. Major effort and major input on those books was Gordon's, but I did my part. But
how did you meet him?
he was selling Orange Crate labels at the flea markets here. And he had started, he's native Californian, and started collecting labels when he was 12 years old. And by the time I met him, he was in his early 20s and was the leader in collecting labels. Mm-hmm. So we met and hit it off well and ended up still to this day being very close partners in all the things we're doing. That's been going on for a quarter of a century now. And we write books that I'm very proud to have published. And they get a good press and people like them.
And can you tell me about your involvement, or founding maybe even, of this of the Archaeological Conservancy? Yeah. and what that does?
Yeah. Well, I'll take a break.
Okay, sure, yeah.
See, it started by Dr. Steve LeBlanc and Tony Berlant, who's an artist whose work he did made with my fingerprint.
Oh.
And Steve was involved with archaeology in the Mimbres Valley in New Mexico. And Tony had been collecting Indian rugs, so they both had a great appreciation of Indian things, and we were horrified at what was going on with people going in and digging up this stuff. And you just get a backhoe and go in there, and when you start seeing toe bones fly up, you stop and look for pots, and it was just sad. And they were both horrified with this, so they approached me, who had some sense of organization, to get involved with them. So we started a foundation called the Mimbres Foundation. And we realized you don't do this by being a nice guy. You save the site. Like the Nature Conservancy, you get into some pretty good hassles. And we went to the state, New Mexico, and got a law passed through the legislature that made it illegal to do this kind of pot hunting.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I met Mark Michael, who started and has been president of the organization ever since. This has been a couple of decades now. And so we succeeded in stopping this Mimbres stuff pretty completely.
Mm-hmm.
And then we said that we could use these ideas to turn into a national organization, but I didn't want to go around with a tin cup and raise money, so the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation and a couple others gave us some pretty good sized chunks of money to do this.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing we did then is get a law through Congress updating the 1906, 1909 Antiquities Act, which put some teeth into doing stuff on federal land, at least.
Right.
There's nothing, no mechanism in this country to stop private use of land, as opposed to most countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But, so, we had very lean years. Right after we started, we had this war chest from the Rockefeller brothers, and we started looking around at talking to state archaeologists, and it turned out the key eastern site in the eastern United States was the Hopewell site in Ohio, which was a big Indian central point. You find obsidian from Yellowstone there, and the mica from Tennessee, and shells from the Gulf of Mexico. There was an enormous trade route, and this was going to be subdivided and destroyed.
Mm.
So we took our whole war chest and bought it. So then I was out with a tin cup for a couple of years, and the organization gradually strengthened. Stuart Udall, who had been Secretary of the Interior, called one day and said, "Hey, I'd like to be involved with you people. Can I help?" And he did. And so under his name, for being a conservationist, the organization slowly grew. And then we started active programs to build our membership. And as I said, now we have about 25,000 active members. And it gives us, I want to keep it small and lean. We have three field offices. Each should have a couple people in them, but that's about it. I don't want it to turn into a bureaucratic organization like the Sierra Club or the Nature Conservancy. Or, and especially not where, in the case of the Sierra Club, anybody in the organization feels that they can speak for the organization, and it works across purposes. So we kept it small, and we're now acquiring a site a month or something like that. And we acquired about 300 of them by now. So I look on that as a conversation I've had with Gordon. If we hadn't done this, what would have happened? The time was right. All we were there just to give it a push forward quicker than implement it. And Gordon said, you know, it may have happened. I don't think it would have happened this way, and it could have taken quite a bit longer, which I agree with. But it would have happened. But this archaeologist stuff, if I hadn't been involved, it wouldn't have happened.
Right.
And that's a very satisfying feeling.
So is that the strategy that the organization is taking now, is the direct purchase of these sites?
Yes, we've always directly purchased them.
Right.
Or appeal to somebody's better nature and have them give them to us.
Right.
And then find some way to find a good final home for it, like in the department.